The hour of 1 o'clock arrived, but call the local government committee to order. First bill on the agenda today is Representative's Bill, House File 1238. Representative's Bill, welcome to the committee, and proceed with your bill. Now, I understand there's only, you have an amendment for one, but my understanding there's only one provision of the bill that really pertains to us. Do you know what that provision is?
That is, Mr. Chair, that is Section 12.
Section 12.
That it would appear, at least on my, in the first committee, in the first engrossment on page 7, as I, if you have the same numbering as I do.
And Section 12, Minnesota Statute, Section 97A. Is that what?
That's correct, 97A-137. And then, Mr. Chair, if you move the bill, I'd like to first just take the A-8 amendment.
Okay, Representative Stearns, moves House File 1238 to be before the committee. And House File, and Representative Stearns, you want to move the amendment also?
Yes, if that's favorable with the author, I'll do the House File H-12-1238-88 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's purely a technical amendment.
So all in favor of the amendment, and want to speak for or against it? Any questions of the amendment?
Okay.
All in favor of the amendment to put the bill in the author the way the author wants it, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment. Bill's been amended. Now you can describe your
bill. Thank you very much. If we can go to Section 12, members, I think you have the engrossment, so it'll start on it's on page 7. And the actual language change begins on line 7.3. This has to do with wildlife management areas that are established in accordance with 86A.05 subdivision 8. And they are, this language would, the first item B would affect WMAs that are 40 contiguous acres and less than 160 acres. That they would be exempt from local ordinances, except that, that restrict trapping, restrict the discharge of archery equipment, and then the amendment that we just did, it would restrict the discharge of shotguns with shot sizes, now it should read F, or .22 in diameter, and restrict noise, restrict dogs on a leash, and would any manner restrict the management of these units under state law. What this is about is that for 160 acres and up, they would be unable to make any changes, and between 40 and 160, they would be able to make changes except relative to these items.
Thank you, Representative Hill. Question for you. When you said on line 712, is that 23 or is that 22?
712, that would be .22 diameter. That is the size of F shot, and that's reflected in the amendment.
Because the amendment I've got, that's reflected in the amendment. Okay.
Yep, that is the amendment.
The amendment. Okay.
It's changing that language to F shot.
I'm reading the bill, and I'm seeing 23.
It got in there as FF and .23, and it should have been F and .22, and that's what the A8 amendment accomplished.
Any questions to the bill from any members? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? If not, Representative Stearns renews his motion that House File 1238 be recommended to pass to be re-referred to the, as amendment, to be re-referred to the Committee on State, Local Government Operations, Reform, Technology, and Election. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed.
Thank you,
sir. Representative Stearns, you want to take the chair?
Okay.
Okay, Representative Nelson, House File 1536. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1536 to be recommended to be passed and move to state government, state and local government operations reform, technology, and elections.
Great, thank you. Do you have any amendments to it that make the bill set, or do we need to offer those, set it out, or they could maybe come later, right? If it will take the bill first?
I have an amendment I'd like to add on to the bill. It should be the A1 amendment.
Okay.
Get the bill in the order, have it in the shape that I'd like it.
Okay, all right, thanks. All right,
it should be in the
so Representative Nelson moves House File 1536-81 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Adopted.
And briefly, what this bill is, and I have here Officer Hentges from the Chief Hentges from the University of Minnesota Police Department. But what this bill has brought to me from the University of Minnesota is that with the new stadium coming and some other issues that they've had, but basically because of the new stadium, the football games will be coming back on campus to deal with issues around that, they're asking for this bill to be passed to give them the authority that they can do this thing. They've been studying for the last few years since they knew the stadium was coming back, studying other, going around the nation's other Big Ten schools that have stadiums on campus and studying how they deal with it and experiences they've had and problems that they've had, and this what this bill tries to do is address those. And I will let Mr. Chief Hentges describe the bill and go from there.
Thank you very much, Chief Chair Sterner and committee.
Introduce yourself. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. My name is Greg Hefferson, Assistant Vice President and Police Chief of the University of Minnesota.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
Thank you, Chief.
Thank you. As the representative mentioned, I've been at the University of Minnesota now since 2003, having retired from Minneapolis Police, and since 2003 we've been running the stadium, the Gopher games at the Metrodome. In 2006, of course, the legislature provided support and the university went ahead with plans for the new TCF Bank Stadium. And while we felt we had a comfort level about running the stadium game day program pretty well, we knew coming back to campus was clearly going to be different. At the Metrodome downtown, we had very little responsibility for managing tailgating type behaviors. There were a couple of sites in downtown Minneapolis. We hired off-duty Minneapolis officers to police them, for instance, up at the Target Center, the new Twin Stadium site was a tailgating lot. But very few, and they're really not located in a residential area, so to speak, where they're going to give a sense to the neighborhood. So we began studying a little bit about what our peers have done. They have solid associations with our other Big Ten police departments. So we conduct our research by reviewing the environmental impact statement ordained by the legislature, particularly including fan behaviors and managing that, their concerns about that. Speaking to the community, being part of planning, but also a variety of road trips we took to our colleagues in Iowa, Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, Illinois, Indiana, and Penn State. It became obvious there were some gaps for us to fill in regulatory authority on our campus when football comes back to campus to adhere to the objectives of the environmental impact statement. Permitting tailgating on campus now will require some authority to regulate those behaviors on campus. For instance, where you can engage in tailgating to include consumption of alcoholic beverages, cooking and the like, when they can begin and stop. Can they use amplification devices at their settings? What decibels, when must that stop? We will also be having tailgating sites in really in three cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Falcon Heights. And after comes to learn that also the State Fair, where we'll be having leasing property as a fourth site, and in two counties. like other agencies, like other university police departments, my authorized staff right now is about 53 officers. I'm not quite there. And it takes, we're projecting it's going to take about 90 officers to operate the game in the stadium, the tailgating, traffic movement, and the like. So like all other major universities, we don't staff year-round for game day. We will hire officers from other agencies under our license for the day. We're part-time University of Minnesota Police Department officers for that day. For us, that somewhat exacerbates the problem of using local ordinances to regulate tailgating, for instance, in all the three cities plus the state fair in the two counties, and having officers from a variety of agencies working for us just for the day. For example, we wouldn't want an officer from Edina who's working for us to have to make the decision, am I in Falcon Heights, am I in St. Paul, what sort of ordinances are applicable. Some of the things we learned in our research is that virtually all of the Big Ten universities have had some level of ordinance-making authority conferred on them by their state legislatures. Some are like us, like the University of Minnesota, at this point in time, our regents have received from the legislature the authority to regulate, create ordinances regulating traffic and parking, that sort of thing. We found that Wisconsin, Michigan, and Michigan State have had that authority expanded to include misdemeanor ordinances to manage other behaviors in the stadium, tailgating, and a variety of others. Others are limited to our concern, or at least the impetus is our concern about running the stadium in a civil way and the campus on that day. And I cited a few other examples of ordinances might be useful to the police department. Presently, the legislature conferred on a few other non-municipal entities, government entities, ordinance-making authorities. Those include the State Fair, Metropolitan Airport Commission, Met Council, and Minnesota Zoo. So what we're trying to do is achieve appropriate regulatory authority to control on-campus behaviors that are critical to delivering a safe and civil experience and carry out the letter and the spirit of the environmental impact statement. So, and certainly stand for questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chief. Are there any questions? Representative Kalin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chief, I want to thank you for your time. I can't remember if it was yesterday or the day before. Answering my questions and general concerns. A question either for the Chair or for Chair Nelson, whether an amendment to, whether you'd be open to and whether it would be germane to this bill, an amendment to ensure that the university is receiving full value for the price for the name sales for the stadium, which is clearly a stadium bill, whether you'd be open to that amendment.
I would not. I understand the issues around the naming of the stadium, and this is not a stadium bill, even though you may think it is more an issue about policing of the game day and policing of the university property. And
Mr. Chair,
and as we point out here in our rules, committee rules, that an amendment, we don't have authority over the U of M in the stadium, and so that in this committee, so we would not be germane in this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Nelson, and committee staff. I'm glad to see that you take this issue as seriously as I do. That I think that we did not get the value for the sale of or for the price that for which we sold the name. And as you know, Mr. Chair, my great grandfather's ties to the football team and having run through that arch in 1927 of a stadium that was named after those who fell in the line of fire. You know, I just wanted to take this opportunity to express it happened before my time here, but I felt like we could have gotten more value for that. But I do want to thank, the question that I had was really related to the stadium, whether one of the key reasons for bringing football back on campus, I never made the trek over as a student myself to the Metrodome. I couldn't bear to do it. It just wasn't, there was no attraction to doing it as a student, even given the tie that my family has. So I'm excited to have football back on campus. And I am glad that Chair Nelson, that you are carrying this bill and making it work so we can have tailgating on campus. We can have the full atmosphere while managing the safety and security of property and people.
Thank you, Representative Kalin. Representative Lanny?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chief, a couple of questions, if I might. Is the primary purpose for this legislation to give you authorization to deal with non-students, to individuals who come to the campus, to the games, who are not students at the university? Is that the prime reason for this?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that would actually be a partial route. We have some for, as we establish the rules surrounding tailgating, we have some leverage over students and the student conduct code if they don't follow the rules and the policies. If, for instance, somebody was non-affiliated, was participating in tailgating there, wouldn't abide by the rules, be it staying too late or, you know, whatever the case may be, a violation of the rules, very limited ability to do anything about that. They're in violation of the university policy, but there's not a lot of force of law to really direct them to comply.
President Lanny?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it really would aid you in dealing with the non-student population. And as far as relating to control of student behavior, does this give you the potential of strengthening your ability to do that? You already have quite a bit of authority and latitude to regulate student behavior on the campus, but does this give you some added benefit of being able to regulate that behavior that you don't have now?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it does. It's not uncommon for us to use a citation or also with a student who's violated a criminal law as well and make a referral to the student judicial conduct. So that gives us a little additional leverage. I might say that one thing we've done so as not to be overly onerous is we've made quite a bit of use for minor infractions of students when we've cited them for a minor criminal violation like underage consuming. They have the option to participate in restorative justice, which gives them an option to have their conviction deferred if they, you know, work with the community and comply with some alternative sanctions. So that we do use that. That is helpful to us as well.
One more question for my chairman, maybe Ms. Dyson, if she could indicate to us, is there any kind of precedent for this? I mean, normally local units of government pass ordinances, not an unelected Board of Regents. Is there some precedence for this kind of thing elsewhere in state law?
Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lanning, as the Chief said, the Metropolitan Airports Commission has ordinance authority, and I believe also he mentioned the State Fair, and they have the authority to, as I understand it, to enact ordinances that control the State Fairgrounds. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dyson. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to share with the committee, I've known Chief Hessness even dating back to his days in the Minneapolis force, and there are few people I think are as skilled at dealing with police community relations, and so I just have a lot of confidence that given some of these additional challenges that the stadium might face, they'll be handled in a way that are, you know, sensitive to the public and the university as well as the broader community and ensuring public safety and enjoyment. So we have to balance the two. So, and they're not mutually exclusive, of course, but I think in this situation we have some worries, right? So I think it'll be handled well, and I have a lot of confidence in the chief.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions? Okay, Representative Taylor?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to speak twice on this bill, but the chief mentioned a program, the restorative justice approach, and I just wanted to raise the awareness for others on this community that the governor's initial budget, I believe this supplemental approach, does include eliminating the restorative justice grant program of $206,000 from the Department of Corrections. And I actually have a bill that may find a means to preserve that program. It does relate directly to this bill in another committee's jurisdiction. I just wanted to point that out to committee members to that here's another approach where I think we're finding value in a program that we need to find a way to fund.
Thank you, Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, I also, I think Mr. Ranieri from the City of Minneapolis would like to express some concerns, and in full closure, there are some issues that are still being worked on between the U of M, between the City of Minneapolis, having to do with some of the language about the broadness of the authority, but they're trying to work this thing through, and hopefully when we get it to the floor, all those issues will be worked out between the groups.
Okay, thank you, Representative Nelson. Mr. Roark, you can also come up to the table now if you wish.
Good afternoon. My name is Peter Grinder.
I'm playing a practical joke on the chief.
Okay, all right, thanks. Go ahead. My name is Peter Grinder. I am the civil deputy for the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office, and I wanted to speak to you today a little bit about some of the concerns that the City of Minneapolis may have with this bill. And I think I would break it down in two primary areas, both relating to Subdivision 1 of the bill. The first concern is the lack of definition or the breadth of what is included in university property. I like the two or three examples that were just mentioned earlier with the State Fair, the MAC, or the Zoo. Those are circumscribed properties. University property is, in this bill, is throughout the state. The university owns numerous properties throughout the City of Minneapolis. So what we're going to have is the effect of laws bouncing around as one traverses through a particular city or through the state. I would note a difference with the state fairgrounds. They have a necessity to have ordinance-making power because by statute they are physically detached from any other city or political subdivision. So there's a real need for them to have ordinance-making authority, whereas the university is covered by city and state law. The other example, the Minnesota Zoo, for example, their authority is limited solely to petty misdemeanors after it goes through departmental rulemaking through the state. They do not have misdemeanor ordinance authority. The airport, for example, and I could be incorrect in this, I believe their authority for ordinances is restricted to traffic and parking regulations. They're also subjected to, obviously, federal regulations. So we have a concern about the breadth and meaning of university property and what is being covered here and the impact on local governmental units as one moves through the physical geography. The second main concern we have, again, is related to Subdivision 1, which is the breadth of the statement that it can pass any law which it considers necessary or proper for the government of the university and the protection, health, safety, and welfare, health, safety, and comfort of the public. That's extremely broad, and I suggest to you that this is neither a stadium bill nor a football bill. It moves far beyond that. Chief Hess indicated that a number of universities, Big Ten universities, have ordinance power to help in the safety of their citizens. That power is exercised is quite broad. Michigan State, for example, covers boating, aircraft, counterfeiting, firearms, telephone and electronic communication, selling and advertising, signage. It's more than addressing football games. The concern that we have here is you have opened the door to giving universities power to govern land use. This language is very similar to what's contained in Chapter 462 of the Municipal Planning Act for land use and zoning. So, in effect, you may be opening the doors for the creation of a separate zoning authority that as one moves through Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the university, things will change as you move through there for zoning. And the other general concern we have is how does the average citizen understand what he or she is doing as she moves through the physical geography? Which ordinances take effect if you move through from one building in the university over to the city of Minneapolis back into the university building? So there are a number of issues I think that need to be more fully considered as we move forward on this bill. I know the city partners with the university on many occasions, and we'd really like to continue to partner with them on this matter.
Okay, thank you very much. Maybe we could do is take the other testifiers first, and then at the end we could see if we have questions. And so, okay, well,
Ms. O'Rourke, why don't you go in there?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I asked the life safety fire question.
Oh, sure, okay. All right, let me, okay. Representative Lanning, yes, there's a question there.
Thank you, Mr. Thank Chairman. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name again, the life safety fire.
Peter Ginder.
Mr. Ginder, to what extent have the concerns that you've raised been discussed with university officials? Have you been involved in discussions with them to this point?
Through the chair, representative, I know that both the city attorney and the university general counsel have had conversations. Chief Hefner and Ms. O'Brien's technical title, Vice President O'Brien over at the university, have met with some of the council members this week to start the dialogue, but I think we're early in the discussion at this stage.
Okay, thank you.
Obviously, there needs to be more discussion, and if this bill were to move out of here today before it comes to the next committee, which I'll be on as well, I would hope that there would be more discussion here between the parties so that some resolution could be achieved. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Ms. O'Rourke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members of the committee, my name is Jennifer O'Rourke with the League of Minnesota Cities. We are the statewide organization for all 850 some cities in the state. Just wanted to be here on record backing up Minneapolis with their concerns in this legislation, because as we read the bill as well, it was pretty broad in a number of instances. Just a few points I wanted to point out to the committee. Subdivision 3 with the enforcement. We're very concerned about the local enforcement on that the police officers and such would have to deal with different kinds of ordinances, rules, and regulations that they would be juggling in this jurisdiction. And then also, in the amendment, I just wanted to address, we appreciate the efforts that are starting line 1.5, dealing with the cost that would be incurred from prosecuting various violations. We appreciate this language. I don't know that it goes far enough, and we'd be interested in working, I guess, with the interested parties as this probably goes forward into the next committee.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Orr. Mr. Ranieri, did you want to say something?
Mr. Chairman, no. I think Mr. Ginder covered it. I'll just be able to answer any questions if there are raised.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Larry. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for either Ms. O'Rourke or Mr. Ginder, would it help us moving through the process if it were limited to only the stadium property area, the areas surrounding the stadium?
Representative Scalzi, part of what the issue here is that they're going to have tailgating, and some of their property is will be on the St. Paul campus, which is in Falcon Heights and in St. Paul. Some of this will be in Minneapolis, so it wouldn't just be around the stadium itself. There'd be outlying lots that they use for parking that some of this stuff will be going on, and that's part of why they're trying to get one set of ordinances that they can enforce in the areas that they have to control. So especially on game day, when they're going from place to place, they don't have to have, like the chief said, a guy and a cop pull out a book and figure out, am I in Falcon Heights, am I in St. Paul, am I in Minneapolis, and what ordinance I have to enforce. They'll have one set of ordinances they go through.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess maybe I didn't state it well enough. Would it help if it stated properties associated with game day, because we obviously know what they are, and they will be somehow mapped out even for the personnel that would be working on game day. They would know which properties we're talking about. So we're not talking about the U of M in Duluth, and we're not talking about Morris, and we're not talking about other properties. We're only talking about the properties connected with the athletic events on the TCF
I'll let the chief
stadium.
Thank you, Representative. Chief, please.
Thank you, to the chair, Representative. Just because the impetus really for this is game day, we've identified a few other gaps that we have presently that we might recommend that the regions draft ordinances to cover. An example for us that we may have covered in our conversation is the public nature of the university and our buildings, for instance. So some of our buildings are public, most of our buildings are public most of the time, and they are closed as other times. Some buildings are never public, our research buildings, etc. The problem for university police officers, for example, are people who are unaffiliated with the university who assert a right to be in the buildings after hours. Where our Carlson School, for example, has closing hours. They would like to permit their student body to remain in there to study if they have a need, but there's been problems with people from the outside. So we're thinking of some additional ordinances might help us regulate a few risks to our property and students like that.
And Mr. Chair, I spoke with Todd Iverson from the university, because that question was brought to me about why Morris and why UND Duluth is, and the university usually makes rules that create, that covers all the university, and that's why they're in there also, because when they make a rule, they want to have one set of rules for University of Minnesota, the Twin City campus, and one for Morris and one for Duluth. We want to have one set of ordinances for the whole university system.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Hornstein, do you have a question?
Well, no, Mr. Chair, I mean, it does seem that the possible compromise here would be, you know, to give this authority for football games and other events, you know, but maybe not have it so broad. But, I mean, that's up to the chair and the parties to work out. But it seems like this should be something that, you know, the comments of the city of Minneapolis and other members have been, I think, on point. But it seems like there's a way out of this. I think the compromise is pretty straightforward.
Okay, thank you,
Mr. Chair. As I said in my statement, they're having their discussions lawyer to lawyer back and forth, trying to work this out, and as they go forward, hopefully we'll come to an agreement with them so that they're comfortable with each other and they know what they want to do.
Okay, and then well, just before I go to Representative Kalin an amendment, but that would be personally my concern that you work, if there's going to be a broad work with the local ordinances and local police departments, whether it's Morris, Duluth, Fulton Heights, or Minneapolis, St. Paul. I think it's important to kind of come together with different departments. So, Representative Kalin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just first to reiterate your thoughts on Representative Hornstein. And I think that Chair Nelson knows, has been aware from the beginning that this, you know, yeah, a decision has to be made about whether this truly is a broad bill or whether it's a football bill. And I reiterate Representative Hornstein's, I think, direction on that. My concern is just pointed to line 2.1 about the notice of the adoption of ordinances, rules, regs by the U, and I've talked to Mr. Iverson about whether the university would be comfortable with this. I just think it's appropriate to add the website to the newspaper, just knowing the nature of our student population these days, and so I think Ms. Dyson has some language that that she suggests that would, I'll ask Ms. Dyson to read it, and then at your discretion, Mr. Chair, I'll move that amendment once you read it.
All right, thank you, Representative Kalin. Ms. Dyson, could you let us know what the amendment states?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kalin, the proposed amendment language is page 2, line 1, after hearing, insert on the university's website on its homepage and.
Okay, thank you. Dyson, does everyone have that? Standing. Representative Kalin, would you like to move that amendment?
Mr. Chair, I will move that amendment, the oral amendment submitted in handwriting by Ms. Dyson, and then would like to ask the Chief or Mr. Iverson or someone else if that language adequately addresses the multiple campus issue. I have a concern about the public safety piece, but I think this is a local government access issue within the purview of this committee, and would like to work it out before we move the bill out of here.
So Mr. Chair and Representative Kalin, you're basically, if I understand this, and if I understand the way to, you're adding publishing on the website above and beyond what's already in the bill.
Correct.
And I would support that.
Okay, thank you, Representative Nelson. Any questions on that, or
Mr. Chairman, Todd, and on behalf of the University of Minnesota, we would be supportive of the amendment.
Would be okay,
and we would interpret that as if we were going to propose an amendment to any one of the campuses, it would be on their home website, their homepage.
Okay, so the Mustangs and the Bulldogs would have the same work on that. So
the Eagles, the Bulldogs, and the Cougars. Yeah.
Okay, Cougars. Okay, all right. All right.
Okay, is that the mascot that poked their head in my office when the University of Minnesota? Was a Cougar.
Yeah.
More
Cougars. All right. Very good.
Rochester, we don't have a mascot yet, but.
Working on the
Wildseed, I'm sure would be able to recommend one.
We'll have discussions with Representative Wildseed about that.
All right. Any more questions on the amendment? All those in favor of the amendment offered, say that. Say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay. Motion prevails, and the amendment's adopted. All right. So the amendment's adopted. Okay. Any other questions or testifiers to this bill? Okay, seeing none.
And just the final word, like I said, my commitment is to continue working with the interested parties here to try and come up with the final compromise that works for everybody. And I understand that there's a sensitive issue there, but some of this has to do, like I said, it came about because of issues that came up out of the Newport State and moving on campus, and it brought up other issues that they're trying to cover all those things in the one so they can have it done. And there's some time sensitive about this because the football game is going to be back on stadium this fall, so they want to be able to get ahead of this before we have problems that later on down the road they have to address and not have the authority to deal with.
Okay, thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Nelson, you renew your motion?
I'd like to renew my motion that House File 1536 be passed as amended and moved to the Government Operations Committee.
Okay, thank you so much. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
So, motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Nelson. The bill is passed on to the Government Operations Committee then. Representative Morrow, come up please.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 1378. Representative Morrow, welcome to the committee, Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I don't know if you want to move the bill first, Representative.
Representative Winkler?
Thank you.
Would you like to move the bill?
So excited. Mr. Chair, I move that House File 1378 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections.
Thank you, Representative Winkler.
And is the bill in the, Mr. Representative Morrow, in the how you want it, or is there an amendment?
There are no amendments right now, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I will mention that I have just talked with Jennifer O'Rourke from the League of Minnesota Cities. Received some suggested minor changes that I think what we'll do is put into amendment form. They concern things like removing the word natural, in order to allow man-made disasters and the like. We'll probably move those amendments in the next committee. They're not of tremendous substance. We could allow Ms. O'Rourke to testify if you like. Otherwise, I think I'll just introduce the bill in its current form, allow the folks to testify, and then answer questions.
I'll talk. At this point, I'll come in my ear here that Representative Falsey likes us to do our work in our committee, and so if we can get that language before we leave the committee here, and so we can get it done here. Otherwise, he frowns on that, and...
Mr. Chair, I was only concerned because I just got these suggestions as I was standing on the top of the room, and I was concerned that they weren't in written form for your committee. With that said, members, Chair Nelson, this bill, House File 1378, concerns local natural disasters. The issue came up to me when a tornado came through St. Peter, Nicollet, and Cleveland, Minnesota, and what happened was a house was blown into a local lake, and unfortunately, because this disaster did not meet FEMA thresholds, the only recourse for Lesueur County was to await legislative action to get state aid to remove the house from the lake. Months and months later, the house remained in the lake until we finally passed a bill to get the house removed. Hank Sadler, who is now the retired emergency management director for Nicola County, came to me and said, Terry, it'd be nice if there were a state fund that was operated by the state emergency management folks that the state, the Department of Public Safety would administer. Therefore, not waiting for either special session or later legislative session during legislative action during a regular session in order to take care of these disasters. So, Chair Nelson and members, we drafted this bill. We have Deputy Director John Kerr here in the audience to answer any questions from the Department of Public Safety. And joining me here, Chair Nelson, are Deb Page, Emergency Management Director from Washington County, and I also have Jed Freed, who is the Legislative Chair for the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers. They can talk more about the challenges that they face and the prospects that they see for this type of bill.
Thank you, Representative Morrow. And can you, welcome to the committee. Can you introduce yourself for the tape and then proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jud Freed, and in addition to being the Legislative Chair for the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers, representing 450-some-odd professional emergency managers throughout the state of Minnesota, I also have the honor of being the Director of Emergency Management and Homeland Security for Ramsey County. I come to you today to talk a little bit quickly about this bill. We prepared for you a brief handout, kind of an overview with some of the big bullet points of where we're going to go here. The main purpose of this bill is simply to recognize the fact that Minnesota is a very disaster-prone state. 44 disasters in our history puts us 17th in the nation. We are looking at probably 45 happening within the week. And all of those things start to add up money-wise, time-wise, and effort-wise on behalf of the local emergency managers and county emergency managers. The bigger problem that we face, however, is that the vast majority of bad things that happen in Minnesota don't raise to that disaster level. As you'll see from some of the paperwork in front of you, for a disaster to become a disaster, the state of Minnesota has to absorb over $6 million worth of damage, and each county has to generate $3.28 of damage in addition to that. So you need something catastrophic, basically, to raise to a federal disaster level. This leaves the local community on the hook for the money. What we're proposing is the same thing that 19 other states in the United States have already done, which is to set up a small fund to bridge that gap so that instead of having to wait until the end of the session and then months, in fact, usually somewhere in the neighborhood of about a year before a local government can even begin to hope to get any of their money back, any aid at all. We want to try and get that done more quickly. The legislation that we're proposing does two major things. The first thing in Section 2 of the bill is it provides funds for local political subdivisions to receive disaster aid the same way they would for a federally presidentially declared disaster, only on a smaller scale, the $400,000 worth of damage that happens to a Hugo or the damage in Browns Valley or in Rogers or in Nicola County. The second part, Section 3, establishes a fund to allow the state of Minnesota, Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, part of the Department of Public Safety, to have a fund to help make the match for federal disaster, because in addition to asking for that money, a lot of the money comes from here. And right now, what has been happening in year after year, most years, in fact, is that we end up having to come before you as an afterthought, trying to beg for money to try and make those disaster matches so that we can even use the federal disaster dollars. So in the end, what we're asking you to do is kind of help us get a little bit of money up front to be sitting there and waiting for us. We're going to come to you anyway and just try and do it somewhat more quickly so that the locals don't have to wait for a year, as Hugo is waiting right now, for some kind of relief from these disasters. These are not things that we can plan for in advance. These are not things that any community can absorb any longer. And as I said, we do come to you anyway, so we're coming to you now kind of before the fact to say, here we are, here's what we think the need is. Can you help us?
Thank you. And you're welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Deb Page, and I am the past president of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers this last year, also the AMC liaison for AMM, and I'm also the Emergency Management Director for Washington County. And I think what I can provide today is just sort of an example of how we end up paying out this money many times anyway. The city of Hugo resides in my county, and as many of us may remember, there was a tornado in Hugo about almost a year ago, or coming up on the anniversary. And most tornadoes will not come to that threshold of federal disaster declaration, and mostly because of the insured property that is involved with it. And so the city of Hugo did have quite a loss from the emergency response to have to pay those individuals, to all of the things that it took to respond to that event and clean up for that event, things like taking houses out of ponds and things like that. We know that the city of Hugo has come forward this year too, to put a bill forward to recoup that funding. And we know that happens quite often. I think that has happened in the Southeast floods from last year too. And you know, I asked Mike Erickson, who is the city administrator for the city of Hugo, if he would have preferred to have the money come to him then, even with a match, versus having to come before the legislature now, and he said yes. That really would have been nice to have that money right away, especially in these times. They were lucky. They had, you know, were a little bit more fiscally settled, but many cities probably aren't and won't be in the near future. So if we have disasters this summer, they may not be as well situated.
Thank you. And Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, in addition to the community you heard from, I've also heard from in Fillmore County, 2007 major winter storm affected Harmony and Spring Valley. They would have been positively affected by this legislation. Heard from Fridley, windstorm September 2005, September 2000 flooding, May 1998 windstorm. Heard from Renville County, a tornado that hit Buffalo Lake City would have benefited from this legislation. Chippewa County, heard of a storm on July 31st. In the past year would have benefited from this legislation. We've heard about Browns Valley, we've heard about Hugo, the list goes on and on. It also includes the Twin Cities. A recent windstorm would have been positively affected by this legislation. Mr. Chair, I also know that we've got a list of where the word natural should be deleted from this legislation. That comes to us from the League of Minnesota Cities suggesting. One concern they had is if there was a man-made disaster, for example, something happens to a dam, a dam leaks, causing flooding, but that leak itself, the damage to the dam is man-made. They would like us to strike the word natural throughout this bill.
Thank you, Representative Morrow. Representative Winkler, did you have a question first before the, or do you want to do the amendment
first? Well, Mr. Chair, I'll do the amendment first. A very nicely handwritten amendment here that Ms. Dyson has, which would, what you do now. It's,
why don't we let Ms. Dyson read the amendment?
Mr. Chair, it's to the effect that Representative Morrow just stated, to strike the word natural from natural disaster so that we can broaden the scope of available funds.
And Ms. Dyson, you want to read the amendment? And
Mr. Chair, delete the word natural on line 1.2, 1.6, 1.10, 1.12, 1.17, 1.19, 2.5, and 2.12. And I will provide that to the committee LA.
Thank you. So Representative Winkler moves the amendment. Is there any questions on the amendment?
Representative Stern.
Well, I just was wondering, do we get a fiscal note for removing all those natural subs down?
As I remind you, we're not a fiscal committee. So,
all right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for my amendment.
Okay.
I'm going to
Winkler.
And this is a follow-up to it's an issue that we dealt with last year with the 35W compensation fund, which is defining, I don't know if there is a technical meaning for natural disaster versus other kinds of disaster. We ended up using, in that case, the word catastrophe because that's what the governor said that night, and so we went with that. But I don't. Are there terms of art for these kinds of designations other than the legal term, like a federally declared disaster area?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the short answer is sort of. There is a term that is a disaster. There is a term that is a catastrophe. The 35W bridge ended up being declared an emergency, not a disaster, because it didn't raise to that level. The biggest problem that we're confronted with is that on the federal end, a disaster only exists if you hit that financial threshold, and then they figure in an impact to the community, usually also based on their ability to carry out community services. So we would be doing exactly the same thing with this without any change in process, so that we don't have to re-educate or reinvent wheels. They do an impact assessment if there's damage that's uninsured public infrastructure loss, and if there's impact to the community, then these funds become available.
Thank you, Mr. Friedman.
Mr. Chair, I guess we should pass the amendment. We might have saved ourselves maybe 3 weeks in conference committee on that bill last year if we had clear understanding of what these words mean. So I'm sensitive to the importance of taking out the word natural, because some people take that to mean, I think, to the exclusion of other kinds of disasters, and I think it would be not advantageous to try to create that limitation.
Any more questions on the amendment? If not, we'll go to vote. All in favor of the amendment, removing, which is basically removing natural wherever it occurs in the bill, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passed. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Any more questions on the bill? Representative Lanning.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Morrow, I agree very much with your proposal here to have some kind of state, full state program to help out in situations where something bad has happened in the community around the state. What I'm wondering about, though, in looking at this, there doesn't appear to be any kind of threshold that has to be reached before this kind of, before a community would be eligible for funding from this pool. Just as I believe the state needs to have a pool of money, reserves that would be available in the event of a disaster, and we do need a definition that we don't have, but I think local communities also need to have some reserves, and I don't think the local communities could or should expect the state to always provide all of what may be needed in cleaning up, and that's why communities have reserves. So I guess my question or concern here is about the need for some kind of threshold which would leave some of the responsibility to the local community to be able to take care of their own.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lang, I see both of my testimonies circling and making notes here, so if you don't mind, I'm going to turn to them because I think there are thresholds and points that they can cover on that question.
Mr. Freed, whichever one. Mr.
Chair, Representative, the legislation requires that the community declare a state of emergency first. In order to do that, they have to declare to the state of Minnesota that they have exceeded their own abilities to cover this disaster, to respond to it, recover from it, mitigate against it. And so there are some basic concepts in here. There is not, however, a bare minimum, it has to be X dollars in there, and that is actually intentional. We run into the risk then of trying to define for the city of X that $1,000 that this is going to cost them isn't enough. And in some of our communities, particularly the smaller communities, the townships that are out there, these communities, some of them simply can't afford the $1,000, whereas a larger city somewhere else in the state could afford that. So that's where the impact assessment part of this legislation comes through, where the state of Minnesota goes there and they do the impact. If there is no impact to the community, it doesn't become a disaster. It doesn't fit any of the bills. So we'd be using those same criteria that we use for a federal disaster, absent the money amount. So instead of a per capita amount, it would be the impact and then their declaration that they cannot do this themselves.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With respect to the first threshold you talked about there, that would seem to be sort of a subjective threshold. And, you know, a community could say, well, we just we can't afford this, but I think we need more than just a subjective determination that that may be the case. And I'm just thinking out loud here, but I'm wondering if a threshold like exceeding a certain percentage of their annual budget, if some costs would exceed a couple of percent of their annual budget, that seems to me would be some kind of a threshold that could be used here. What I worry about is even with $6 million could evaporate pretty quickly if there isn't some kind of threshold here that's clearly understood and that local communities have to take some of that responsibility on.
Page 3.
I would probably just echo Mr. Freed, but also that I believe that we probably don't. We're not looking at the complete, you know, in here it states that there will be procedures and timelines established by the Commissioner of Public Safety. And as Mr. Freed said, we do need to go by the damage assessment guidelines that FEMA currently has. And those guidelines are fairly stiff. I mean, you know, if they have a lot of insured property, they're not going to receive funding. And we take all of those things into consideration. So if they're receiving funding through other forces or through other areas, I believe those things will be taken into consideration from an impact perspective. And if we have to call the guard in, that is one huge understanding that we have gone beyond our resources that we can pay to bring in, and other regional resources that have had to come in for that.
And Mr. Chair,
Mr. Freed,
Representative, also there is in this a 10% match by the locality. So they're not scot-free on this at all. We're following the guidelines that are there. Currently for a federal disaster, the state of Minnesota makes up 25% of the disaster funding that comes in. And that's split 15% by the state itself and then 10% by the affected county or city of the first class. We would keep that 10% match so that for exactly the reasons that you stated. We wouldn't want this to be, pardon the word, a handout or incentive for somebody to simply say, well, this is beyond us because we don't have $2. So they would still be paying some amount of this. And again, we would then be trusting to the experts in impact assessment, as we do right now for federal disaster, at the State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, to come in and say, you know, there is an impact to this community, and then we're taking the community's word that there is an impact to the community, combining them together, saying, okay, you have $1,000 worth of damage that you can't cover, come up with $100, and the other $900 comes out of the available fund.
Representative Lanning.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Morrow, if it's okay with you, I'd like to visit with you before the next stop, and maybe we can work out some language here that would give me a little more satisfaction and that you might agree to as well. So.
And Representative Morrow, if there are guidelines for FEMA that we could get a copy of those so that at the next committee that probably would answer the question. I think. But Representative Biskin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and technically, as I read the bill, it doesn't answer the question, right? Simply, you know, we talked about these guidelines, right? But the intent of the legislation, I believe, is best stated on page 2, lines 5 and line 6, that do not qualify for presidential disaster declaration. So we go through, we do the checklist. We don't get the federal money. Well, shoot, a pothole doesn't get the federal money, but that could be a disaster in a real small community. Right? So there, and now it would have to qualify. And I believe you know, Representative Lanning hit the nail on the head. If I turn to page 1, line 14, you notice that it's the local government making a local declaration of emergency. I heard some discussion about some criteria, but there is no criteria in the bill. It's wide open if you read the language. So it's whatever they want to make the determination. Then you go down to line 1.17 and 1.18. Within the limits of the funds available under this section, the state director must award the grants. This money is burnt up in about 2 weeks of the fiscal year, because the local government gets to determine what the disaster is, make the declaration, just ensure it's small enough that it doesn't fit the FEMA criteria, and then there has to be an award granted. I empathize with what's going on. There needs to be some fixing up here, right, as we move forward. It just doesn't work at this point.
Mr. Chair, if I might ask, I'm going to invite Mr. Kerr up to join us as well from the Department of Public Safety. It's not as simple as that, and I only know that after hours and hours and hours of discussion about this bill. There are procedures in place. They'll talk about Chapter 12. They'll explain what has to go on. It's not simply St. Peter gets to say we had a disaster right at the check. So I'll let the experts explain the process that's embedded in this legislation.
Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Kerr. I'm the Deputy Director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management in the Department of Public Safety. As I think has been alluded to here, when we have any type of significant event, the affected local governments are asked to conduct what we call an initial damage assessment. We provide forms and a process, if you will, for that. Based on the information we receive from them, we may suggest to the governor that the state of Minnesota request what's called a preliminary damage assessment. And that process involves federal officials coming to the state of Minnesota, pairing up with some state and local officials, and doing a very quick assessment of the worst damage sites in the area for some type of verification, if you will, that the damage estimates that the jurisdiction has arrived at appear to be accurate. Based upon the information we received from that PDA, we then will probably recommend to the governor that he request a presidential declaration or not request a presidential declaration. So that's just a quick snapshot of the process.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then would it not be prudent on page 1, line 14, after the word emergency, to insert the statutory requirement or verbiage, so make a local declaration of emergency pursuant to Minnesota statute, wherever the devil it is, or rule or something, so that it is very clear how this local declaration has been made.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it certainly could be, it perhaps would add some clarity to make the connection in that portion of the bill with Chapter 12 and with the existing process that's followed for to seek a presidential disaster declaration.
So, Ms. Dyson,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Dyson, would you do, what is that the right statute, Statute 12, or?
Mr. Chair, I would defer to the witness on what, but if I understand what he says, if it's
yes,
a local
Chairman.
Declaration of emergency under Chapter 12, is that specific enough for the members, I guess is the question.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So, Representative Distin, so would you be comfortable with what you're saying is on line 1.14 after emergency stating, putting a reference to Chapter 12?
Mr. Chair, it sounds like this is still a work in progress, so I'm not interested in offering any oral amendment, just some insight as it moves forward.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morrow.
Mr. Chair, at one level, what I'm hearing is yes, experts here find that the feel that the language is clear as it stands, but we are open to giving greater comfort to those who are concerned that if they feel there may be some ambiguity. I need direction either from the chair or from Representative Biskins. If we want to put in pursuant to Chapter 12, I'm happy to do it. But I don't. I need to then know that that's the comfort language that would suffice. And this is not to say that Representative Lang, I still hope to talk with you before the next committee that you and I both serve on.
Mr. Chair, I guess my suggestion would be that we not kind of make it up on the fly without counsel being the one offering it. So Representative Biskins is also on the next committee, so Terry won't get by with this without addressing it.
So are there more questions for the testifier? Representative Turner.
Yeah, I just
make it quick because we've got two more bills to go in 20
thank
minutes.
You. I'm usually a quick talker most of the time here. So. It feels a good bill, but I kind of share concerns about the risk management cities sometimes with insurance, and that the cities that take care of adequate property and casualty and flood insurance, and that they an adequate fiscal reserves, they usually take care of the program, and sometimes the cities and townships that aren't taking care of proper insurance, they tend to get the money because they're not planning. And my concern is that it doesn't replace adequate management of the city, and that whether it's fiscal or risk management type. So,
Representative Morrow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Turner, that's a fair comment. I would just remind members that the way we do it now is we get up on the House floor, we go to a committee, and a member makes an impassioned plea for a community to get money. What we're trying to do here is to put in a process and procedure with criteria judged by the experts that get funding to cities and to townships and to communities expediently without the cost of a special session. So I do respect Representative Lanning, Representative Biskins, Representative Sterner. I'll be happy to talk about clarifying the language. But the intent of this legislation is to actually take out the uncertainty, take out the on-the-spot decision-making, and to allow the experts to aid our communities as expeditiously as possible. So members, I will talk with Representative Biskins, Representative Lanning, Representative Sterner. Thank you very much for that comment. I'll talk with the folks here.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Kalin, can we got two more bills.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Just to the point that Representative Morrow just raised, I do hear the concerns, but twofold. One, I think Mr. Freed, you and I believe that you were on the ground at the Wyoming training in Chisago County that I witnessed. We have a long way to go at the local level, but at the same time, our AMM members, emergency managers around the state do a phenomenal job, and have actually, during the 35W bridge, when MnDOT's folks were not fully prepared, it was locals who stepped in, and I think we all know Rocco Forte in the city of Minneapolis did a great job they did, but it is the service at the local level that is happening because of the professionals like Ms. Page and Mr. Freed. And there's a point at which the 2-3-4 hour response becomes a question of 12, 24, and 48 hours. And the contingency plans get much more complicated. And the last thing that they should be worried about is how are we going to make sure the mutual aid and other agreements get taken care of, extending to the state. It's really critical that this essentially a semi-open appropriation in some ways, be part of that so that we have the security to make sure that the response is focused on the response, not on the paperwork.
So Representative Winkler renews his motion that House File 1378 as amendment be recommended to pass and re-referred to the state government or state and local government operations reform technology and elections committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Representative Chieftain. Dog collar. Representative Chieftain, to your bill. Representative... Representative Turner, would you move the bill?
Yes, I'd love to move House File 936.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen. You want to explain your bill?
And Mr. Chair, there's an amendment as well that would be useful to move.
Representative Turner moves the amendment, the A1, 936A1 amendment.
Yeah, 936A1 amendment. I'd also would move that amendment.
All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Explain your bill, Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is a first step in the direction of trying to address and think about and deal with the big demographic challenges we have coming down the road here with our aging population. And it builds on some work that we did as a legislature last year, which was to provide some pilot project money to build communities and for communities at the local level to coordinate their efforts for addressing long-term care issues. And what this bill essentially sets down the path of is to do something like we have with our Star City programs and other programs like that, which would essentially allow on a voluntary basis a single city or a group of cities or a region, and that's a self-defining, that's self-defined, to come together, set up a board essentially, and think through how are we going to plan our community in the future? How are we going to incorporate into our municipal plans, our long-term plans, the fact that we're going to need systems in place for housing and transportation and volunteer activities and a whole variety of things to address the fact that we're going to have a lot more older people in Minnesota in 10 years and 15 years than we do today. And so what the bill does is it defines what these communities of a lifetime are and some of the things that they should be thinking about, and then it tasks the Minnesota Board on Aging to develop a process for cities or other regions to apply to get this designation. And that is the extent of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Easton. Is there any questions of the representative? Representative Beard.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Easton, I'm noticing that it says that it's to encourage them to seek designation, but it, is the task force legislation still in here? And the delete all?
It is not.
Oh, good, because that was my question.
Here.
If we're going to do task force, that would seem to imply that we're going to eventually let this experience mission creep into a mandate, but thank you for taking the task force legislation on.
Yes. And it should have, it actually has no fiscal notes. The Board of Aging is going to do this work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Any more questions of the testifier, of the representative? If not, all those in calm, anybody in the audience want to speak for or against the bill? Seeing none? Representative Winkler renews, or excuse me, Representative Turner renews his motion that House File 936 as amendment be passed and referred to, recommended to be passed and re-referred to the Office of the Committee on State, Local Government Operations and Reform. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Bill is passed as amended. Representative Winkler. Representative Winkler, would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 1423 be recommended pass and re-referred to the full committee. I do have a delete everything amendment that I'd like to offer, the DE1.
And would explain your amendment and you move your amendment?
Mr. Chair, I'll get to the amendment. But essentially this amendment is the goal to find common ground between the administration, counties, and cities, and it has succeeded in displeasing all of them. So, Mr. Chair, I would move the amendment. And I'll talk about the substance of the bill after we have it in place.
Okay. Representative Winkler moves the amendment DE1, 1423 DE1 to... all those in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Explain your bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, members, this bill is an initiative of the administration, and it's simple. The goal is to, as originally drafted, was to ask cities and counties and townships to utilize the state purchasing program that the state has in place currently with the goal of saving money. We have, there's a major carve-out in the bill. I wouldn't even say it's a carve-out. It's a way of making the mandate a lot less mandate-y, and that is to say that they only have to do so if it's practical and cost-effective. So in other words, if they already can get a deal elsewhere that saves, that is cheaper than the state deal, they don't have to do it. Or if there's some reason like they don't want to have to drive 4 hours in order to buy, to pick up a part, or they don't want to have to have service provided by somebody that's outside their community, that would not be a practical solution for them. So the goal is to provide some discretion and ask that cities, counties, and townships take a renewed emphasis on looking for ways to save money. The amendment basically just changed the whenever practicable and cost-effective language and moved it to the front of the language, just, I think, to emphasize that point. And the second part of the amendment creates an alternative that they can, that in addition to the state cooperative purchasing venture, they may also utilize the national municipal associations purchasing alliance or cooperative created by the joint powers agreement. So to the extent these cooperative purchasing entities already exist as efforts from cities and counties pooled together already, they can use that as an alternative. The state doesn't like the amendment because they were intending to invest some resources into this cooperative purchasing venture, and they feel like it may not be a good use of their resources to do so if cities and counties can go elsewhere for their cooperative purchasing needs. And of course, cities and counties don't like it because it contains the word must, even with the carve-out language at the beginning. So I'd be happy to take questions, but the goal is to create a renewed emphasis on saving money by purchasing in a pooled format.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Winslow, I just have a question. When you talk about resources, I'm wondering what that means if, when you say it, you said resources. I can't remember in which context, state resources. And I did bring this up to you just briefly, but which department would handle this, and does it require the use of additional state resources or additional state employees?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi, first of all, it's in the Department of Administration, which already does the state purchasing and has a lot of overlapping contracts for cities and counties already. So things that cities and counties need, the state also needs to a significant degree. So this is not a new department or a new division. This is expanding what they already have. There's no requirement that they add employees or staff or do anything else. It just simply anticipates that there would be this joint venture out there. I know it's their intention to perhaps hire some more people to do this, but there's nothing in the bill that would require them to do that. And in fact, I think to their concern about the fact that cities and counties can choose a different cooperative purchasing venture instead of the state, there's nothing here that says the state actually has to make that investment on the front end. They could wait and see if cities and counties share that interest, or if there are gaps in the purchasing pools that are available that they need to fill before pursuing that path.
Representative Scalzi.
Yes, and then on the other hand, then would if there's a local business or a local some type of local venture that could supply it, maybe a little bit higher cost, but would make some sense for the local community. Is that, do you think that would be covered under practicable?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi, I think that would maybe depend, and maybe it would depend on a little bit of a broad definition of practicable. I think the idea would be that there's some service reason or there's some quality reason why it makes a lot more sense for it to be a local vendor providing it. If they're selling the same hammer, if the hardware store, you need to run out and buy a hammer because you have a construction project that's a hammer short, that would be a practical reason why you wouldn't go through the state's purchasing pool. If you're buying, especially your tool sets and toolboxes and tool trays a lot around here, as an analogy, if you're buying big sets of tools, and you can buy the exact one set through the state for $100 and through the local hardware store for $150, and once you have it, there's no other point to it, then I guess it would indicate that they should buy the cheaper one.
Representative Diskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I read through this amendment, correct me if I'm not Representative Wincourt, if the municipality does go through and purchase through the cooperative, right, there is assurance that the cooperative is getting the best price possible because the cooperative itself has to go through the competitive bid process before securing. Is that not, is that how the law reads, the current law? And I point to specifically line 1.12 of the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I have to read the language here to answer. He has the advantage of not having to talk the whole time. Let me see. Mr. Chair, I can't answer your question based on the language. There may be a testifier who could try to address that.
Mr. Chair, we could answer it now. Representative Winkle, I'll see it again.
There's somebody coming down. Okay. Representative Sterner.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to express my concern and discussion that I'm totally opposed to this bill. I think it's exact opposite the way that it should be reflected. When we talk about the green economy talks about buying things locally is important from your vendor, and I would like to have it go the opposite way, where we're talking about whenever practical and possible, we buy it locally, unless it's unreasonable. And so this is polar opposite. I don't think the local chamber supported, as well as the cities, and I know my cities and my county and my school district are very well managed, and when we got a $5 billion deficit here, and we don't have a planning agency or not a comprehensive guide plan, behooves me to say we're going to pass this stuff and tell local governments how to run their business and our local economy. So I'm going to oppose this bill all the way through, and I hope you help me shut it down.
Representative Beard.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. Back to Representative Winkler's hammer. Since 1992, if your city hall runs down the street and buys a hammer at the hardware store, they pay sales tax on it. If the state was to put together this cooperative adventure, would there be sales tax on that hammer if they bought it through the state? And that's kind of a rhetorical question, actually. But it gives you an idea for a great amendment if you want to have at least the League of Minnesota Cities back on your side. And I don't know that that necessarily is your agenda here, but if you want to offer an amendment that would delete the sales tax on governmental purchases, especially for local units of government, you'd have a love fest of local people, and I would be happy to support you.
Representative Beard and Representative Winkler, that probably wouldn't be germane in this committee, but...
Mr. Chair, I'd like to see Representative Beard offer that in the tax committee.
Sure. But Representative Winkler, as part of our local government mandates that we were looking at with Representative Lanning's committee, that was one item that was brought up by the cities and the counties, mm-hmm. That one of the biggest mandates that they have taken off was having to pay sales tax, but it would have a huge impact on our state budget, and they were, even though they would like to see it, they were wise enough not to bring it forward because they knew it wouldn't go anywhere.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to over-explain my little illustration here, but as long as I think you said this is an administration bill, if the administration is really trying to, and I know that they do have the best of intentions, and Mr. Chairman, if they're looking to save local units of government a bunch of money, that's a very easy fix to throw into play that could help us out.
Representative Winkler, you have a testifier here, and somebody wants to speak. And please, welcome to the committee. Well, please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Kent Allen, and I'm the Materials Management Division Director in the Department of Administration. Just in response to that one question that was asked, where Representative Winkler indicated that a testifier may be able to address it, the language involved is actually not new language. It's part of what's been in the statute for some time. And my understanding of it is that it would require that any other cooperative that was offering these sorts of services to local governments would need to have gone through a competitive process.
Thank you. Any more questions on the bill? Anybody else in the audience would like to speak for or against the bill?
Come on. I can feel it at my back.
And we've got 3 minutes left or we could be kicked out of here, so be concise if you can.
Let's go first. I'm Scott Simmons with the Association of Minnesota Counties. To kick things off, I don't want to be the skunk at the party, but I guess there are some concerns with the amendment. It is overly prescriptive, as Representative Winkler even acknowledged, and Steve Kent Allen. The problem is it creates a scenario where counties, cities, local governments actually have to exhaust the list of purchasing cooperatives that are out there that we may not even know of yet before we can find an alternative. So it really goes probably too far in the endeavor to find savings. We would prefer actually the starting point to be the original bill and work off of that. But I guess that's our initial opposition to the amendment. And
which is the bill.
Which is now the bill, yes. Correct.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time, and I'll be brief. I think it's fair to say that our preference on this issue would actually be no bill. We have lots of cities, actually, and there are around 290 cities, I think, that take advantage of the state's cooperative purchasing plan at the state level. And to their credit, they actually have Seattle and Los Angeles, California, as two cities who take part in the state system. So they are doing something right, obviously. The league itself has worked with the department to broadcast this to members to get folks interested. And frankly, we would like cities to participate in this more. But having it in statute is something, I guess, we don't know that you really need to do. We understand that the governors and others would like to see this number increased. And like I said, we're happy to help ramp up those efforts. I know that we do have cities who participate in other purchasing ventures, such as the service cooperatives at the local level. I know there's a lot of partnering through joint venture cooperations, like Representative Stirner referred to, where the county and the city, or the county and the school district, or the city and the school district and the township all work together to purchase items. And I'd like to highlight for the committee that actually this statute that you see, going back to the original bill on lines 1.11 through 1.6, is actually language that the league and the counties brought forward just a few years ago, asking you for the authority to participate in some of these that were going on at the national level, like U.S. communities and some of those joint ventures through the National League of Cities. I would just finally appreciate the discussion that occurred on this today, and if there was a sales tax amendment added to this kind of provision, it certainly might change our position.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, maybe to address one of the questions that was raised earlier. Counties participate, and cities and schools do as well, in a program, a cooperative program called U.S. Communities. There's just shy of 1,000 participating local units of government that participate in a national purchasing cooperative called U.S. Communities. And to participate as a vendor in U.S. Communities, you do have to go through a competitive process to participate in it. This is a non-profit entity that AMC encourages our members to participate in to find a more price-effective purchasing at the county level. Now, I think there's 87 counties, obviously, but there's more than that of county entities that are already belonging to U.S. Communities. So we have a high participation rate in the cooperative that already exists for us, and we've been doing that through the U.S. Communities for some 20 years now. And the state's operation, according to their budget page, there's 84 out of 87 counties participating in the state's purchasing pool. So I think just as representing counties, we're already doing the kind of work that the bill seeks to accomplish. And so if there's any... we want cooperation with the state. We want to be partners as much as we can. We would like to see our counties be able to purchase off of both without having that mandate saying we have to go to the state's plan first, because we think we've got a pretty good deal now. And I think what was articulated at the beginning, there may be some gaps or holes in some of the commodities that we need to identify. And we're willing to go forward with the author and try to find those to get better value for taxpayers.
Thank you, Mr. Simmons. And I'd just like to say before I get to Representative Winkler, last year in the workers' comp bill that I carried, we had to actually put in there language to allow the state and the Department of Labor and Industry through workers' comp to be able to go outside of the state purchasing for instances where you have to get a wheelchair or equipment quickly for someone that's injured. You can't wait to go through the state purchasing pool. They need it today, not 6 months from now. So with that, Representative Winkler, is there anything you want to do to wrap up?
Mr. Chair, first I'm going to just request that you lay the bill over. And appreciate the discussion. I know it disappoints Representative Hornstein not to be able to support me, but I you know, we can work together on something else, Frank.
I want to
make a comment about that. I've been here a little over 2 years now, and based on the testimony I've heard here, every single agency, municipality, and governmental entity of any kind whatsoever operates effectively and well and perfectly, and the only challenge that we face as a state is that the state doesn't spend enough money on them. And that seems to be the recurring theme I hear all the time. The fact of the matter is that even in a very difficult budget situation that we're in, there really has been no serious effort to look at how to reform practices in the state of Minnesota at the state or local level. And even, I think, a very minor bill that actually doesn't require anybody to do anything that isn't in their best interest in terms of price or quality of service, it runs into a buzzsaw. And I'm unfortunate, I guess, that I think it's unfortunate that we are not more serious as a legislature and as a state government, including from the administration, about looking at cost drivers for state government and revenue needs. And so, Mr. Chair, I'm going to lay it over, but I'm frustrated that even in tough times we can't seem to get our act together and try to do business in a better way.
Thank you, Representative Wakeley. And with that, I'll lay the bill over, and hopefully we can work on it and go from there. Representative Turner moved the minutes from previous meeting.
Yes.
March 16th. I was looking for that. Okay, the meeting of March 16th.
Yep, I read the minutes over.
All those in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.